What's up, What's the Res listeners? This is Ethan Delves bringing you analysis and insight on the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. Today, I bring you a strategy episode because on this podcast, Josh and I have talked a lot about different resolutions and different debate strategies spanning from definitions, different paradigms, and even some LD values, but we haven't really gotten down to what it means to write a well-structured debate case. And I feel like it's time to put this on the podcast and kind of get it out there. What does a debater do in order to write a well-structured and good case that they can bring into a tournament that is compelling and it's well organized in a manner that it can refute the opponent's case well and stand its own ground? So in this episode, we're going to be going over all of the different aspects of a debate case and the best way to go about formulating a case so that you can go into a tournament or in a competition and feel confident in your argumentative skill. So to begin this episode, I want to start at the very beginning. What should you do even before you start writing a debate case? The answer is research. A lot of debaters, when they read resolutions, their minds will automatically default to the most obvious argument that they could possibly make. And this can be problematic because when you default to a certain argument, your mindset gets very stagnant and you'll tend to focus on that argument a lot in your research. While if you research the topic first, just type in the topic or things related to that topic and read just as much as you can, go on a reading spree, then your mind will actually be open to a lot of different avenues of argumentation. So I would completely recommend researching evidence first, or just researching the topic and reading about it, familiarizing yourself with it. And this will help you actually get arguments out in the future and not stay stuck on one very obvious argument, which gives you a couple of advantages. One, you'll have arguments that tend to be a little bit different than that of the opponent's. Two, you'll probably find some additional evidence that will set your case apart and the opponents will be less prepared for. And three, the most important one, this will really help you during cross-examination, because cross-examination and rebuttal speeches are all on your feet. You can write a constructive speech and you can give it, and that's great. But once you get to rebuttal and cross-examination, things can become problematic, because if you don't understand what you're talking about from an understanding and familiarization perspective, then you're really unable to think on your feet and answer questions effectively. I found that researching the topic beforehand is the most useful way to make sure that you're prepared for cross-examination. So it's a really good method, and I highly recommend researching and then coming up with arguments after. So after you've done some research, What should you begin to do as far as formulating your case goes? The answer is to formulate an introduction paragraph. This can look different for a couple of different kinds of debate. The LD introduction won't look the same as the policy introduction, but all types of debate do have an introduction that they use. And there's really two aspects that are similar throughout all of them. Again, this is just going to be a very simple kind of debate case structure. An introduction should be compelling, and it should use some very basic facts. What I mean by this is that when you have an introduction, you want to use a couple of facts in it in order to indicate the weight of your side of the resolution. What that means is, I'll actually provide you an example. The last Coolidge resolution went something like this. The United States government should prioritize reducing the federal debt. And when you look at this resolution, you know that the federal debt is a very large debt, but in order to completely convey that, I used a fact at the beginning of my affirmative case that went something like this. In the time that it took you to tie your shoes this morning, we became $100,000 more in debt. And when the opponent and the judge hear that, it's a wow factor. I mean, who would have thought that you could gain $100,000 in debt just by tying your shoes in the morning in that increment of time? So when you use some very basic facts, not something that you would use in a contention or anything completely major, an advantage, disadvantage, impact, but just a very basic overview fact, and implement that into your introduction, it can be a really powerful mechanism for the judge and opponent to understand what your stance is and how major your stance is on the resolution. It's a really good thing to put right off the bat, just almost like a hook sort of introduction. But then you also implement some facts to back that up so that people's eyes just completely open to it. Now, after you have an introduction, a lot of debates implement a status quo, And a status quo is basically just the current situation of the world. So you put the resolution in context of where the world is at, and you say, what's the current situation? And the current situation will oftentimes be what the negative team is arguing for, because the affirmative team oftentimes argues for a change in the status quo, and the affirmative team wants to implement a new policy, change something economically maybe. And this means that the affirmative is arguing for a change. The negative, not all the time, but a lot of the time, argues for the status quo or the current situation of the world and how it applies to the resolution. Now, in public forum debate, it's very well known to have a status quo right after your introduction, or some people just hop straight into the status quo and start talking about the current situation and why it's bad and why it's good and listing off all of those reasons, and that's great. In other types of debate like Coolidge debate and Lincoln-Douglas debate, the status quo isn't clearly defined, but it'll find a way to kind of sneak in there, and people will start to get a sense of the current situation even if it's not explicitly named. A good way to do this is in public forum, go and make a section for your status quo. Again, don't take too long for it, because in public forum debate, you only have 4 minutes for your constructive speech, and you want to use that as wisely as possible to get enough facts out to support your side of the resolution. Just give a quick statement on what the current situation is. You can even cite some facts, and it can even be implemented into your introduction to kind of mold those two together. But for other types of debate, I wouldn't recommend making a specific section for the status quo. It's a really good place to kind of talk about the current situation in your introduction, and this can even be supplemented by some of those basic facts that I was talking about. But in public forum debate, you're going to want to make a section for the status quo, tell what the current situation is, and then at the very end of your status quo, tell the judge what you think of the current situation. The affirmative might say, I want to change the current situation, and here are my reasons why, and then go into contentions. The negative team might say, the current situation is the most beneficial or the best situation, and here, I'll tell you why now with my contentions. But the status quo should name the current situation and name your stance on the current situation, which will be different for affirmative and negative teams. Now, definitions are the next session, the third section of a debate case. Public forum debate will name these definitions for the terms in the resolution and rarely define any other terms. Policy is also kind of like this, but in Lincoln-Douglas debate, you're going to have to define a lot more terms because you have to implement things such as values and value criterions. But for a basic debate case structure, you're going to want to look at the resolution, and you can also refer to our episode on debate definitions. I think it was episode 8 or episode 10 on What's the Res for how to define terms and what's the proper way to define terms. But for a basic case structure, after the status quo, you're going to want to name the terms in a very brief manner and use a source to define the words in the resolution that are significant enough to warrant defining. These words would be definitely the nouns and the actors in the resolution, as well as any of the terms usually in the predicate need to be defined, because limits need to be put on the debate in order for a debate to be had. The best way to go about doing definitions is to have a reputable source. I would highly recommend Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary. They're a really helpful dictionary. They have very brief and solid definitions. And if your opponent questions what your definitions are or how reputable they are, if you name Merriam-Webster as a source, you'll pretty much be good to go. And these need to be fast, they need to be fair, and they need to be clear. And then you need to move on, because cases can move really fast, but the time restraints on the cases move even faster. And you need to make sure that you get your arguments in. So name the word and the definition and make sure you get all of those out, and then move on. And remember, it's the affirmative's burden on the resolution to provide the definitions. Since the affirmative team typically, in some kinds of debate, like Lincoln-Douglas, has a little bit longer to speak, the affirmative has to name what the definitions are. The negative team, if it disagrees with the definitions that the affirmative has, can go back and refute with some different definitions if the negative feels that the affirmatives are unfair in any way. But the affirmative needs to name the definitions, and negative, if you agree with the affirmative's definitions, move on. Want to get stuck saying unnecessary definitions that you don't need to when you could be moving on to refute the affirmative case or build your own negative. So that wraps up definitions. We finished the introduction section, making sure that we have compelling facts. We also have the status quo section talking about the current situation and your stance on it. Thirdly, we have the definition section talking about giving basic definitions with reputable sources, especially if you are the affirmative team. So the next section, the fourth section of a debate case, is your contentions. I highly recommend 3 or 4 contentions per case. I would keep this pretty standard throughout different types of debate. 3 or 4 arguments tends to work really well for building a holistic debate case and hitting all of the major aspects of a stance on the resolution. there are a couple of different parts to a contention. First is the headline or the tagline. A lot of debaters will ask for this in the cross-examination for their opponent, and it's a really useful thing to bring out. If you have a tagline, what it is, it is a declarative statement that names what the argument it is about. It's almost like a title of the argument, if you will. And when you have a tagline, again, it should be a declarative statement, and it should make sure to encompass what you will be talking about inside of your argument. It can be very simple, just one sentence, and I like to put it in bold on my cases to make sure that I can find it very easily because it's an important part of my contention. And when you're giving a constructive speech, what you're going to want to do is when you're saying your arguments, name the number that you're on, contention one, and then read the tagline and then go into the argument. It's a really good way to help judges and opponents stay organized while you're in a debate round. After you have a tagline, again, the declarative statement, you're going to want to move into the actual argument itself. And what I like to use is something called the Toulmin model of argumentation. I learned this at the Calvin Coolidge Foundation 2 years ago, and it's been really helpful in helping me build my debate cases. So I'll share it with you now. The Toulmin model has three parts to it. First is the claim. And the claim that you make is a short description about simply what you are saying, the claim that you're making. It's very simple to the tagline. It's almost like an explanation of the tagline. You make declarative claims about what you're saying, and then later on will come evidence to help support those claims. A good example would be, let's say we have a resolution about tariffs, and the negative team is saying that tariffs harm the economy. What you're going to want to do is say that in your claim part, you're going to say that tariffs harm the economy and elaborate on that as much as you would like to. But keeping it simple is also something really good to do, and that's what I like to do. So you could say tariffs harm the economy. Great, we have aspect one. Aspect two is the warrant, and I'll actually go on to name the evidence part before we go to the warrant because it kind of all glues together really nicely when you think about it like this. So you have the claim, then you have the evidence, but there's a part in the middle that's called the warrant, which is the second aspect of the Toulmin model. And it's really important to recognize because the warrant is the reason for which you're using the evidence to back up the claim that you're making. The analogy I like to use is how when police officers have to search someone's house, they need a warrant to go into the house or a reason for searching the house. And this is given to them by a court or a judge. Now, warrants are important because you just like a police officer needs a reason to go and search a house, a debater needs a reason to use certain evidence for a claim. Oftentimes, the warrant is implied and it's very obvious why you're using certain evidence to support a claim. However, when evidence doesn't seem to connect to the claim that you're making, debaters will come up to you in cross-ex and ask you, what's going on with a warrant here? Why don't you have a warrant? Or what is your warrant for the argument that you're using? And if it's unclear how your evidence connects to your claim, that can be dangerous for your argument. So if it's implied in your argument and it seems really obvious why you're using evidence, for my tariff example, if tariffs harden the economy, maybe my evidence will be, in 2014, we've removed tariffs from the economy, and the GDP grew by 1.5%. Maybe that's my evidence. And the evidence very clearly connects. Why can I use this evidence? Well, we took tariffs away and the economy grew. Therefore, they were harming the economy before. Maybe that's the argument that I'm making. The warrant is very clear. In some cases, the warrant isn't clear, but you're going to want to make sure that you have a sentence for it or a reason describing how the evidence connects so that you don't run into trouble in the cross-examination. So just a quick review in order this time of the Toulmin model. One, you have your claim. What are you saying about this argument? Two, you have the warrant. How does this claim connect to the evidence that you're proposing? And three is the evidence itself. What facts do you have to back up the argument that you're making? A good place to go for evidence would be online think tanks such as the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Urban Institute, Manhattan Institute. There's so many of them that I could go into. And there's also law reviews are really good for Lincoln Douglas cases and a multitude of news articles from reputable news sources. All of those places are great places to go over evidence, but always remember to connect it to the claim that you're making. So now that you have the tagline, the Toulmin model of argumentation, there's a couple more things that you're going to want to include. In most cases, debaters would call these impacts. Right after the argument, you finish making your argument. Impacts are a way of saying, why does your argument matter? What's the significance of this argument? And a good impact for maybe going back to the tariff example, saying that tariffs harm the economy, you have evidence for it. What's an impact? Why does that matter? Well, we need our economy to be strong for these reasons might be a good impact. Or right now we have tariffs, and if we remove these tariffs, we could expect to see more economic growth and accomplish these things with the additional funds that we would have as a country. Really plain and simple. You just want to name what the significance of your argument is, and you can go into so many different fields of thought with impacts and many different avenues as to why growing the economy matters. What could you do with a grown economy? What has a grown economy been known to have effects in different areas in the past? There's so many things you could name about a growing economy in our tariff example that would make the argument more compelling and make it more appealing to the judge to vote in favor of someone who's making that argument, because you can see why it matters. So those are the main parts of a contention. You have the tagline, just the title of the argument. Again, really good for cross-examination. Opponent says, what was your second argument? You read them the tagline. Cross-examination moves smoothly and quickly. Then you have the Toulmin model of argumentation. You make your claim, you have evidence for it, and you explain how your evidence connects to the claim. Then you have the impacts. Why does your argument matter? And a lot of debaters won't include this, but it's a really helpful thing that debaters should include, and it's going to look really good if you do, because the judge will have more appeal to what you're saying. So does anything come after contentions? The answer is maybe. In some cases, people like to have a conclusion and make a conclusion a really compelling kind of call to action almost for the judge. They want to say, vote in favor of the affirmative, vote in favor of the negative. Most experienced debaters will do this, and I would recommend making a very small conclusion to your case, but I wouldn't recommend making it really long, because that takes away from the time that you have to put into your contentions and actually making your arguments. But after your arguments, you don't want to simply sit down, say, again, list the taglines of your arguments at the very end of your speech. It's a really good, helpful thing to do, so the judge can keep track. Okay, this speaker made three arguments, and it was about this, this, and this. Main really short, but you can see how it's effective in summarizing what you just said to make sure that the judge and the opponent and yourself are all on the same page with what case you're giving. You want your case to be really clear, not so that your opponent can effectively refute it, but so that the judge can keep really good track of what you're saying, can give you a huge advantage in the final speech if the opponent has not done a good job postmarking what they're doing in the debate and where they have done it. It's a really effective strategy that I recommend you go slow on. Make a very simple and slow conclusion statement, but make sure that you name what your arguments were, and again, why your side of the resolution in a very summarized and holistic view needs to be voted for. What is the factor that the judge needs to vote on? Why is your stance on the resolution important? That's the most important thing to include in your conclusion. So now that we've gone through the basic parts of a debate structure, there are a couple nuances that occurred between different types of debate. For a couple of those nuances now, just so we have clear that there are different types of things you need to include for different types of debate, and square that off really quick. So Lincoln-Douglas debate first. Lincoln-Douglas has a Lincoln-Douglas value as well as a criterion, and these are essential factors to include in a debate case. I remember on my first Lincoln-Douglas debate, I did not include a criterion. And while I did win this round because the opponent brought up new information, it was a struggle to get through the round without a way to measure my value. Basically, what a Lincoln-Douglas value is the top priority for the round, or the top standard. All of your arguments should relate to the value and help promote the value. A good example would be, say, the value of social justice, for example. If you have the value of social justice and your stance on the resolution is promoting social justice, all three of your arguments should have claims and evidence that help support and uplift and increase social justice in society, is a really basic way of thinking about it. Place to put this value, the best place to put it, I would recommend, or where I usually put it, is at the end of the introduction. First, I name my stance on the resolution and a couple of basic facts that show why it is important to vote for this stance and why I'm arguing this stance. And at the end of that introduction, I say, for these reasons, I value X for the round. And I define what the value is using maybe a philosopher who helped coin the term, or I wouldn't recommend using a traditional dictionary. There are usually a lot of sites that give a better analysis of what a Lincoln-Douglas value means. So I would look that up separately from maybe a Merriam-Webster definition. But you want to get your value clearly defined in the manner that you mean to use it for your debate round. And you might have to sort through a couple of sources to do this, but it's very much worth it. Again, this is for Lincoln-Douglas debate. So I like to include my value at the end of the introduction, get it out there, whatever you do, before the contentions, because your contentions, the intention of those is to connect to the value and help promote the value. Thinking about this is through the value of social justice. Maybe I give a really compelling introduction of how there is no social justice in the status quo, but if we reach for this higher moral standard, on the affirmative side of the resolution, we can promote social justice and have a better world. I would say, judge for these reasons, in my introduction, I promote social justice as the highest value of the round. And my all of my arguments after that have to connect to social justice in a way that they help promote social justice and increase it and give respect to it. And in order to define what your value means, you're going to want to go to a lot of sites and read the different definitions and even different types of justice, such as Josh talked about in a previous episode, if you're going for that example, and find the best way to define it for the case that you are using and the case that you intend to make. After you define your value using not a traditional dictionary, but again, going to maybe philosophy quotes or a philosopher's quotes about that value, maybe the person who coined the term, a philosopher who heavily agreed with that term, then you can implement their knowledge as to what it means and then go on to the value criterion, which comes right after the value. The value criterion in its most simple term or simple definition is a term that that helps measure the value. What I mean by that is that you can have a very lofty value and goal out there for all of your arguments, but you need a way for that to be measured by the judge and by your opponent to see if you have won the round and fulfilled your obligation. Justice can be a really difficult thing to measure. Like, how do you measure the amount of justice in a society? Well, maybe you would measure it by this might be a really bad way of measuring it, by the way, but the amount of protests. If the amount of protests about racial injustice or injustice in different areas goes down, then you have achieved social justice. I would highly recommend against using a way of measuring by the decrease in protests because it's kind of detached from how you want to measure it. Maybe a better way of measuring social justice would be how many people were put in prison for a certain race, if that's more equal. Because right now, racially speaking, there's a very big divide as far as who is put in prison and who is not. Maybe a good way to measure social justice would be more fairly implementing the criminal justice system in a certain debate case so that social justice is evident in the fact that there's no discrimination in the criminal justice system. And that would later warrant proving that there's discrimination in the criminal justice system and having hard evidence to back that up. But that's a good way to measure, a good concrete way to measure how social justice is promoted in society. Now that we have that, in the Lincoln Douglas case, again, I recommend putting at the end of the introduction or right after the introduction. It's a really good way to kick off and get started with your case. But no matter what, you always want to make sure that it is before your contentions because your contentions have to connect to the value and how the value is measured. As far as the status quo goes in Lincoln Douglas debate, the current situation can kind of be measured by the way you implement your introduction. If you name your stance on the introduction, you almost have to talk about how the current situation is. So I leave the status quo to public forum debaters to clearly define. As far as LD debate goes, you're going to want to name your stance on the resolution, and the judge and the opponent, you'll find as you're writing this and reading this off to them, they'll kind of get a sense for the general air of the situation that the resolution implements or the resolution talks about, and you won't really need to use so much time actually defining what that is concretely. So you'll be safe there. Policy debate is a little bit different, and right after your introduction and policy debate, you have something called a plan. This is for the affirmative team specifically. Now, a plan consists of four different parts because in a policy debate, you're usually arguing for changing something on the affirmative. You want to implement a new policy, so let's go do that. How do you do that? You have four different parts of your plan. You need a plan statement. How will you go about implementing this new policy? That's the question you have to answer. The question you have to answer for the second one is agency. Who will implement this policy? A very common answer to that question is the U.S. Congress, because the Congress is able to implement policies and new laws and new regulations. The next question is about funding. Who will fund this? A very, again, common answer is the U.S. federal government. And tax dollars will fund this. It's a very common answer. Lastly is the time frame. When will this policy be implemented? I actually have not ever done an official policy debate, but in the practice debates that I've done, I found that sometimes debaters will miss some aspects of a plan. And if you miss the aspects of the plan, particularly funding is one of them that gets missed sometimes, it can be dangerous for your case because you're not sure how the plan will go through. And you can name the most beautiful arguments that you want to, but if you don't have a way to implement them, that's a downfall in policy debate. So make sure you answer the question, how will the policy be implemented? Who will implement it? What will the funding be? Who will pay for it? and when will it be implemented by? And that should serve as an affirmative plan and make sure that you get through the debate cleanly with a clear view of where you want to go. As far as public forum debate goes, public forum debate is really known for the status quo and throwing a ton of facts out there, which I have nothing against, and making sure that you have enough facts to prove your side of the resolution. It's not as philosophically oriented as Lincoln-Douglas debate, and in case you can't tell, that is my favorite kind of debate. I love Lincoln-Douglas, but I also debated public forum for a long time and really enjoyed my time there. I recognized that public forum debate was the only type of debate that clearly defined the status quo or the current situation of the world. So what you're going to want to do is, as I stated earlier, after your introduction, say, okay, the status quo is, name what the current situation is, and again, name your stance on it. This is bad because, or this is good because. Then the judge has a framework to kind of look at your arguments through and see, okay, I'm looking for why the status quo is bad through these arguments. And it kind of serves for a standard for the judge to seek it while they're judging you and while they're judging your opponent as well. Final things to get down for the rest of building a debate case. So we've talked about Lincoln-Douglas debate, policy debate, and public forum debate, as well as the basic case structure that kind of fits all of those with the nuances that comes with the different styles of debate. So is there anything else that we need to know about building a debate case? We will have an episode coming later for framework, which is an entirely different kind of way of framing the debate and putting limits on the debate and giving the judge a lens to look through as far as judging your case goes, which we will have another episode coming on to describe what a framework is and how to build a framework, because that gets kind of complicated. But for a basic case structure, the examples that I have given to you now prove what a basic case structure is and will serve as a very good model for building a debate case. But there are a couple of extra things that we should know. Some final tips. First, split up the time for your debate case well. When you're writing a case, you usually get up to a month to write a case for a single resolution. And there's a reason for this. It's because it takes a long time and new evidence can come up very rapidly. When you're writing a case, make sure to, again, first read as much as you can about the resolution and go slowly through the case. Focus on it in order. Introduction, then you go to your status quo if you're going to name one specifically in public forum, for example. Then definitions and your contentions, and build each contention with care. Split up your time well and don't do it the night before, because I know how that feels and it's a really terrible idea and it feels awful. So don't do that. Now, another final tip would be keeping an eye out for new data, because new data, a lot of the debate topics are actually selected based on current events and what's going on in the world right now. This can change overnight. I remember a resolution about the Thaad missile system, which was by Lockheed Martin, and how it is I'm not really sure what the resolution said about it, like a good or bad system to have, or we should have it in South Korea or shouldn't have it in South Korea. And some missiles were fired off literally like the day before we had the tournament, and everyone was rushing to get to this data and to get to this story, or maybe even the week of the tournament or something like that. And it was crazy, crazy public forum debate, because this stuff happens so rapidly. Keep up to date and make sure that you have the most up-to-date information. And that can be stressful sometimes, but if you do it with consistency in mind and splitting up your time well, you will be able to have the right facts at the time that you need them. Another thing to think about is the different types of resources that you can use for putting together your arguments as far as your evidence goes. Again, think tanks, law reviews, philosophical quotes are something that LD debaters really like to use at the beginning of their cases. If you're writing an LD case, if you just want to state a quote right off the bat, get up there, time starts, you state some kind of broad quote that leads into your introduction, it's a really cool idea, but a lot of people do it. So if you want to be unique, maybe you could think of something else, but as far as LD debate goes, I think it's a really cool way to start the case. It's just with a really broad quote that your introduction just feeds into, and it sounds really, really good. Another reason I really like Lincoln-Douglas debate. To kind of draw everything together, building a debate case can be a really difficult thing, and this episode has covered the basic aspects of building a debate case. And while there are many other things to consider, again, these are the basics. These are the fundamentals that you need to get down in order to build an effective case. Now, since this episode was a pretty basic overview of how to build a case, I would love to take any questions about building a debate case and give my insight as to how to build a case more effectively or any of the aspects of a case that I talked about. Both Josh and myself are 100% open to any emails for questions as far as case building goes, because case building, again, can be a really difficult thing, but we're here to help. We love debate, and we are ready to answer any of the questions that you have about case building. So I hope this episode was helpful. I hope that you walk away with this knowing or having some direction as far as case building goes for your next tournament or for your next case that you're working on. And if you have any questions, please email us at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's whatstheres@gmail.com. And follow us on Instagram. And please feel free to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. This is Ethan Delves with What's the Res. And until next time, work hard, speak well, and seek the truth. We'll see you in the next episode.